Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Well, good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And this week, we're bringing you a bit of a designer show. Yes, because joining me, I have Anne Odling-Smee, a leading designer who has worked with the British Museum, Royal Academy of Arts, South Bank Centre and the Tate, but has more recently turned her skills to the world of science and science communication, founding Design Science. Good morning, Anne. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks very much for inviting me.
On this cold and very, very wet day, you braved it all the way into the studio. Could you tell us a little bit more about what Design Science is and what it does?
Yes, Design Science is a company I set up in 2011, having run my previous company, which still goes, called OSB Design, working for the arts 10 years before that. And it was through teaching at Central St Martin's on a course called Communication Design that I realised that I was getting rather frustrated with the design I was doing myself and its limitations, and realising that design has such a huge value beyond the art world. So over time, I started with the idea of setting up a PhD, exploring how design could be applied to science. But very quickly, it became more clear that we needed to start doing practical work. So we started to realise...
So you actually got rid of the PhD and just jumped straight in.
Well, I became pregnant as well. So the PhD suddenly became a completely, no way is that going to happen. So I think there were also financial implications of the fact that I needed to make this financially viable at the same time.
And we're going to be hearing all about what you do, your projects throughout the show. But for anybody listening, our experiment this week is going to be hearing your top tips for how to design your message and communicate it across. And we've made it into a little bit of a challenge as well, in through the medium of the perfect poster. So if you want to join in with the challenge at home, just grab some pen and paper and listen out. It's coming up just before the second song. And of course, we want to hear from you as always. So you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And the question we're asking you this week is, what is your favourite font? Now, there is a reason why I'm asking you this. Not only is a font, you know, a really interesting element of design, and when we read words, it's like the first thing we see, it conveys a tone and a mood. But Anne, you actually did your degree in typography, didn't you?
I did, and many scientists are a bit alarmed when they hear that I spent 4 years studying typography. If only they knew what an amazing subject it was. I think it would be fantastic for everybody to learn their history through typography. It is a way of learning about history. There's a very good film that might inspire those who might be a bit cynical about this called Helvetica, which was produced a few years ago. And it does make the point about how important and how big a part of society typefaces are. So that follows the story of Helvetica, which is quite a recent typeface. I mean, not many people know that Hitler abolished black letter when he was in power. So there are some very strong, powerful stories that go alongside typography.
And also Steve Jobs, I know that he dropped out of university but then hung around sleeping on his friend's floor and carried on attending the calligraphy classes.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and you know, Apple is sort of what we hold up as the modern pinnacle of design.
I think it says a lot about how successful it's become.
Now, on to your first song. What have we got and why?
Okay, I've got Duke Ellington's Caravan. My song list is very much to try and be a broad variety of all the songs I like, because I don't have any particular style, but I do love jazz. And I think this one goes back to, you can sort of tell African roots. I spent some time travelling when I was younger, and I love the way this has those African feelings about it.
Charles Frederick Worth was the first designer to have his label sewn into the garments that he created in the mid-19th century.
Now, I really like that fact, because that is what I think about when people talk about design. Straight away, I think of designer clothes and furniture, maybe some from Copenhagen. But I don't ever think of design as something that you could use as a communication tool. And I think it's my own ignorance, really. I don't think I understand what is design. So can we start there? What is design?
I think that's a very reasonable thing to say. I think design is a really difficult subject to define. We started off with trying to define both science and design, and strange enough, we ended up in a pub on one of our discussions and asked the barman if he could do it, and he was much more eloquent in defining science than he was design. He completely fumbled when it came to trying to work out what design was.
I think it's something where, like, a good design, you almost don't notice. It's when it's bad that you do notice it. Like, if a product is well designed, you're just like, this is a great product. But if it's badly designed, you're like, oh, this is annoying. And then you notice that it's badly designed.
I think the other problem is that design is, in the same way that science is everywhere, design is everywhere, even more so. And, I mean, the clothes we wear are designed, our hairstyles are designed. Every bit of furniture and house and building is designed. And then you ask yourself, you talk about evolution and nature is designed. So you end up getting confused because you don't really know what isn't design. And I think we are talking here with design science about communication design. And yes, you're right. I think with the iPhones, it's interesting because they are very beautifully designed and intuitive. So you don't even need to ask how to use it. You sort of know. And that's an amazing design achievement. And I think even though a lot of scientists are now working with these kinds of design interventions, they're still not making the connection between good design in their mobiles and good design in their communication. And it's not a completely different concept. It's about making things work well, efficiently. One of the big things we're trying to say is there is a problem with people thinking design is about money and an indulgence, and designer clothes costs more money because they have this label on them. We are really advocating for design to be a money-saving process, so that if something is designed better, for example, for the NHS, we can make that we can make the NHS work better by having elements within it more sensibly designed.
And so what elements would come into the sort of areas that you would design? You've done websites and films, and you've even designed a waiting room. I mean, is there anything that you wouldn't take on, or what would you say is kind of the areas that are included in communication design?
Well, that's another issue. I mean, historically, design as a subject hasn't even been around for 100 years yet. It kind of only started to exist in the 1950s.
Really?
Yeah, and I think now it's everywhere, and the number of designers are growing exponentially, with people wanting to study the subject. We used to have illustrators and artists, or technical illustrators, and we had typesetters who would set the type, and they had a specific role. The designer is the first person who's brought all of these together. And when I was a student, we were still learning how to set metal type. I'm only 43, but actually my tutors didn't know how to use computers.
What do you mean by set metal type? Is that like a printing thing?
Exactly. So this is how, until before computers, which only really were everywhere in the, you know, that we started to have desktop computers in the 1980s. But in the first half of the 20th century, newspapers were set in little pieces of metal type, where every letter was a piece of metal type that overnight somebody had to set. Well, lots of people would set a newspaper, but it was a very, very manual process with little lines of lead in between, which is where the term leading comes from, when you have... It's still used in digital typography without really meaning anything. So it's a massive change since Gutenberg did his Bible in 1455, I think is when it was, the invention of metal type. We've been, for 500 years, we've been working with metal type as a way of printing and as a way of setting text, and now it's completely different.
And why do you think, so you sort of mentioned earlier that design can be a way to make things more efficient in science communication, but what do you think are the challenges of communicating science that design can help to overcome?
I think designers sit in an interesting place in between disciplines. We are not really a discipline ourselves. Many designers might argue this, but we are the difference between, for example, scientists, designers and artists, which is something we've had to be working quite hard to explain to science people, is that we don't have our own message to impart. We are literally there to deliver the message of the client, and we should not be delivering another message. We should simply be making decisions about the way we visualise and verbalise their content to make it as effective as possible at communicating to its recipient, to its audience, intended audience. So the intended audience is extremely important to our process. We need to understand that audience. We also need to understand the science. So we have to become semi-experts in the subject of the science in order that the recipient does not have to do that work. And by doing that, we should then use our other skills of how we communicate to perhaps less informed audiences about how we find the best way to get maybe some of those complex messages across in a way that they will understand. And mostly it's about language. I mean, one of the first conversations I had when we set up Design Science was with Professor Ottoline Laser, who is now director of the Sainsbury Laboratory in Cambridge. I think she's a fantastic scientist in plant science. And she said, I think just about any kind of science can be understood by anybody, and it's simply the way it's told is the problem, and the language, and the fact that different science subjects, different disciplines within science need different languages. We need to have them. They have to carry on. But we need another language that will help communicate that across disciplines of science and to lay people who don't understand those languages at all.
Right. Well, I think this is the perfect time for our poster challenge. So you have a message that you're challenging me and producer Kyle to communicate through the form of a poster. And we will have the next song in which to create our poster. So our resources are not huge. We have pen, paper, we have some colours.
That's enough. That's
we're
enough.
Very keen though. So
yeah, and our imaginations. What is the message that we should try
the message? So I would like you to design a poster that tries to get people to use less packaging in the first place. So we've got a big problem with the environment, as we all know, apart from some people like Trump, who don't know. Let's not go there. But we, so I think our governments are all telling us to do recycling, and we have constant recycling bins that are getting bigger and bigger, but we're producing so much waste in the first place. I've given lectures about this, particularly in Sweden, actually, where I was teaching for a while. Why can't there be rules about using less packaging? And as consumers, can we try to make choices that use less packaging? And could you design a poster? And I think a lot of the news at the moment is about how we communicate. In terms of your audience, it would be good to get to communicate to most people, maybe uneducated, less educated people who don't have privileged backgrounds, everything else, who may not be so sure about the reasons for why we need to be worrying about this. Could you communicate a poster to those people to get them to use less packaging in the first place?
All right, you're on. Challenge accepted. And for anyone listening at home, if you want to take part, grab pen and paper, and you have the next song as well. You can tweet us in any posters that you create. So all we need now is the next song. What is it going to be?
Okay, the next song is Soul Kitchen by The Doors, and it's my partner was teasing me for having The Doors in, but I think The Doors are such an influential band, and I think when you hear their music and so much music that follows on, you realise how we haven't moved on much. I think they stand in between classical music and modern music in an interesting way. So
a picture can be processed 60,000 times faster than text because our brain can process the whole image at once. An image is also more likely to engage us emotionally. This is why images are an important tool for fast, effective communication.
And I, at the very last second, was like, I need a picture on my poster! shall we describe to you? Do you want to describe to the listeners what you can see, and then you can critique it as you go?
You describe it first and then I'll critique it.
So, I have gone for a big, bold, central piece. Two words, very large. They're sort of taking up a good half of my page, and they say, "Buy naked!" I thought that would catch people's attention. Everyone, you know, is attracted to sex, and that sounds sexy. And then underneath, packaging is choking our planet, which is maybe not the clearest way of putting it, but it sounds scary. And then underneath that, slightly bigger again, no one wants to wear plastic. And then this is the part where I panicked about not having a picture. So I've drawn at the top right-hand corner, a happy apple on its own. And then a sad apple in a plastic bag, or at least that's what it's supposed to be. And it's on a nice, bold, blue bit of paper. But, there we go. Yeah, okay.
You've chosen a very nice font.
Thanks. Yeah. It's the only one I know how to do.
Very good. Are we looking at Kyle's next, or just should we look at yours? Let's have a comparison.
Yeah, so what I've done is I've tried to, you know, the little guy you see on packages who's throwing something in a bin?
Yeah, like the kind of bin recycling symbol.
Yeah, the like bin recycling guy. So I've tried to draw him, but with nothing there.
Oh.
Now, that's like my image that I'm trying to go for. Now, I've got a slogan at the bottom, which just says, don't dispose, don't use at all, which I think probably needs some work. So I think the slogan's lacking, but the picture's like my main idea.
The slogan needs a rhyme almost.
Yeah, I just couldn't think of a rhyme. 3 minutes is just not long enough.
Not quite enough. Right, let's have the expert analysis.
Well, for a few minutes, that's quite an impressive start. So it's quite interesting how time pressure can help with design, actually. That's another story. So what you've both done is something that I'm finding is becoming an issue with the way people are designing those sorts of messages, is it's quite bossy. And I think this is something, since I've had my toddler, who's now 3, you realise how badly they respond to being told, don't do this. So I'm talking about the editorial before we get into the visual side. And this is something that's come up. In fact, the Science Gallery in Dublin did a quite interesting exhibition about this. Or they started to do some, I think it was an exhibition, where they talked about climate change and trying to make climate change messages work for the younger generation, who do not really respond to this telling off
commanding tone.
And actually, I don't think any human really does. So the first thing I would say is I think there needs to be a more
a softer tone,
a less parental sort of voice. And I think the Buy Naked is that's actually a positive. That has more positive connotations, and I think that is quite a good way of starting getting the attraction in the first place. I think the images at the moment, the way you put your images, are sort of filling a spare space in the corner, and that's the sort of worst way to design. You definitely need to do images and text simultaneously and think about them as a connected message. It is true that images communicate in an instant, but it is amazing how images with a different text next to them will communicate a completely different message in a similar amount of time. So the way the real power is in images and text working together.
Right, yes, of course, because I guess if you have a banana and the word smile, it's completely different from a banana and the word monkey.
Or the word packaging.
Yeah,
you will read into that banana in as many different ways as the text will allow.
Cool, and so what are some other things that people often do wrong, and what are your kind of top tips for communicating in an effective way?
So the main thing people do wrong is they try to have far too much on a poster, and particularly the science community are locked into a rather irritating, I find, tradition, or a troublesome tradition. I shouldn't be rude, I love the science community, but these science posters, I don't know where these have come from, but they are embedded in such a... I worked on with the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine to produce some redesigns of the templates that they used to produce for these. But still, we had to have this kind of method, results, conclusion, and loads of content. And they are basically what I would call short papers. Supposed to be a poster. A poster is not it's not something that people go up and read. It's a momentary piece of communication. So I think for the science community, it would be really good if we could start realizing that posters sit in a way to grab the attention and make you realize the subject matter, and then the next level of information needs to be elsewhere, either in a leaflet, online, in a brochure. So the main thing is having too much information. And the other one is something I was discussing with you earlier, is since the invention of computers, we have so many graphic variables at our disposal for free. So we can use 1,000 typefaces on one poster. We can use drop shadows and special effects. And people do. They just want them all in. They think that that's going to help.
It's like a kid in a sweet shop.
It's completely overkill. So the main thing is to try and just don't have more than one message. Don't try to communicate more than one. The minute you add another message, you're immediately cancelling out or reducing the other message. And then to try and, in the environment we live in, which was saturated with information and visuals, and you go, I mean, now you go in the tube and it's not just static visuals, it's videos. People need, the only way your poster is going to stand out is if it's actually calmer than everybody else's and if it just has a bit of slowness. So I think we could all do better with just having less and saying more.
Less is more. I love it. And that's that thing with negative space, isn't it? Actually,
yes.
Space is as important to your design as the words and the pictures themselves.
Yes, and I think space should be thought of as an active part of the poster. So there's dead space and then there's active space. And if you do think of space as an element and you don't just think of it as a kind of leftover, you can use space in very powerful ways.
What is song number three?
So this is my classical section. So I sometimes wonder what I really want to listen. I love a lot of classical music, and I think Mozart is one of my favourites. So this is Piano Concerto number 21. And I was brought up in a house where my father used to play extremely loud classical music. And my mum as well, and they hated pop music because they said it was so repetitive. And of course, as I get older, I sort of see that point, even though it used to drive me nuts. But this, I think, is a very beautiful piece of music.
Colour is one of the most powerful methods of design, but the different colours will mean different things to different cultures. In Japan, purple is a celebratory colour, but in China, it's black.
I thought that was so interesting, because over here we think of black as sort of mourning and very serious or very sophisticated, but never celebratory. Ironically, I'm all in black today, but there we go. So, Anne, we have talked a little bit about kind of what design is and how it can help science. But what are the challenges for the designers when it comes to working with science?
Okay, I think this is a really important point. So having worked in design schools for a very long time, I started when I was 28 doing teaching at Camberwell College of Arts. There is one of the reasons none of the students go into design for science sort of jobs is that we don't have any relationship with the science community anymore. Somehow something happens at schools where, I remember this, where you had to choose your subjects, and I went to the end of boys' school where girls definitely weren't expected to learn science. I mean, I think things have changed considerably now, thank goodness. But nevertheless, if you choose an art subject, you go into the arts world and you sort of say goodbye to science, and ditto if you go into the science world. So my sister, who writes for Nature, she misses the arts because she's had to let go of that. So I think there is a lot of the design students I have got very good understanding of the arts. The other thing is that design schools are situated within art schools, as because of the thing that I told you earlier about design being very new. We haven't really established as our own subject. We still belong within the art school community, which is at the moment, I think, is one of the problems, that we're associated as much with art as with any other subject. And I think ideally we should be situated alongside all subjects. So there should be design schools in physics departments, in chemistry departments, in geography departments. We've become joined to the art world in what I think is now an unhelpful way. We now need to educate. The problem now is that the designers are nervous working with science material because they don't understand it, and they get intimidated by the language. And there is this kind of strange social hierarchy of the disciplines where the science community, the science is
Because I guess even at school, like, the science is considered the hard subject, and if you're really clever, you can do science, which is, I think, a really bad way to look at it, because I found art incredibly hard, and I look at amazing artists and pieces of work, and I'm just like, how have you managed to do that? And the thing that I found hard was not having structure. They'd be like, okay, this is your topic, black, yeah, go yeah, and create yeah. something. And I'd be like, where do I begin? I think it's amazing for someone who can have a vision on such sort of small input.
I don't really understand why this is. I mean, somebody said it quite well, I can't remember who it was, about the idea that if you go to a dinner party and if you say you know nothing about science, you're completely socially accepted by a dinner party. You know, the general public find that that's not a problem. If you say you know nothing about art and culture, you're sort of sneered upon. At least that was a perspective from a scientist. I'm not sure if it's quite like that. I think it all depends on who's there. But I do think there's a strange, almost inverted snobbery around science if you don't know the subject. So we really need to do something about this. I would really like to set up courses in design for science. I believe we need them. I think this problem about design being such a huge subject, as I said earlier, is we can't just keep teaching design in such a broad way, and some courses are beginning to sort of narrow down what they're calling themselves. But I think we need to become more subject related because we have plenty enough content within the design to be able to start splitting ourselves up a bit, as well as carrying on. You know, we don't want to split ourselves up to the point we only we do more divisive behaviour, but we still need to be in touch with each other.
And before you set up Design Science, you did a lot of work with the art world and kind of those big institutions that I talked about at the top of the show. What have you found is different since you've started doing Design Science? I mean, how have you tackled these challenges in your own projects?
I think design for the art world has become a bit too much of an indulgence. I think the art world is saturated with good design. The Tate Gallery was set up, the Tate Modern, while I was working as a designer, and you can see what that's done to the way that the public are engaging with the arts now. It's really good. But I think we need the same to happen for the science community now. I think we need to catch up. I think it will be a much tougher process because of the fact that we don't have the relationship in the first place. Yes. Now I am so much more fulfilled. I mean, I just love my job again. I was getting bored because also I was having to fight against my own vision as opposed to the artist's vision. You can't actually do anything with the artwork because it's already creatively complete.
Yeah.
Whereas the science community, there's so much more. It's so much more creative. This is the irony.
So you can have more of an impact.
I can do so much more. We can make films and we can create the visuals ourselves. The visuals haven't been done for us. So the idea that the science world is less creative than the art world couldn't be less true.
And what's been your favourite project, do you think, that you've worked on?
There's one that I'm very proud of, which is we redesigned a waiting room at the Haemophilia Centre at the Royal Free Hospital for a very low budget when the new professor just came into position. And I think the reason that happened so smoothly was that we didn't really check with the powers that be whether or not we were really allowed to do it, so we just got on with it, and by the time anybody noticed, it was too late, and it made a massive difference. So this Haemophilia Centre was actually, it has a controversial history because it's where the contaminated blood happened, which caused lots of AIDS problems in the, I think it was in 1980s. So a lot of patients remember this story above and beyond actually all of the fantastic work that organisation is doing. So we created a timeline in the waiting room, and we took away all these sort of, as I've told you before, these kind of bossy NHS warning signs and leaflets and things that nobody ever looks at. And we put in much more, we put up some wallpaper and we painted it and we made it a nicer feeling space. And then this timeline tells the history of the centre and its amazing achievements, and it includes this bit about the HIV controversy, and it makes clear that this was really an accidental, you know, nobody had foreseen it was a genuine accident. Obviously should never have happened, but it doesn't hide that, it doesn't hide the good and bads, but it puts it in a context. And so these patients,
so that they can then also see the amazing work that came
exactly
out of
they can have confidence, and also they can read something useful about their own condition while they're waiting. I don't understand why waiting rooms in the NHS don't make more of the fact that this is a moment when, instead of reading crap magazines that are lying around, you could actually learn something useful in a time when you've got time, because you're just waiting for an indefinite period. And So I've been told that it's worked very well, and there's, you know, the patients are liking it, and lots of patients go back over and over because they are constantly, you know, they're haemophilia long-term patients. I wish we could do more of it, and I know that it's because of all this bureaucracy that we that it's just that people are afraid of even asking the question of doing it. For such a small amount of money, you can make a huge difference in these spaces, and you can make them educational as well as environmentally a nice environment.
And environments are really important for how people feel about themselves, and that's really important for people getting better. I really stupidly always think of it. Have you ever seen the game The Sims? The computer game?
A bit.
You have to look after these kind of humans, and they've got various bars of needs, such as energy and hunger, and one of them is room. And I never really understood this when I was younger, but if you surround them with nice objects and, you know, you put wallpaper on the walls, their room bar will be high. And if you, you know, build a really cheap house with no wallpaper, their room bar will be low. And it really affects their mood.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
And I just, that's...
I think people are recognising there's some fantastic work going on in children's hospitals. There's an organisation that I was told about very recently, and I've now forgotten what it's called, who are actively... bringing art and design in a really positive way, not just plonking these rather hideous paintings on walls, but actually doing something interactive with spaces and making the children's environments far absolutely changed. I mean, our daughter has been in hospital at Great Ormond Street, so we know how tense it is, and to have toys and to have visuals makes an amazing difference. I think we should be focusing on adults as well. I think adults need their version of this.
I think it's brilliant that you said a waiting room as well, because off the top of my head, I would never have thought of that as being something that would come under a sort of design remit. But
I think we need to think much more about designing mundane spaces. We need to think more about designing where there isn't design, and stop thinking about designing where there is too much of it. And we seem to be redesigning design all the time. And actually, there are just...
finding all those other opportunities to communicate.
Exactly.
What is song number four?
Now I've lost my list again. I can probably remember it. Apologies, I've got it. I should have written this down. Okay. Oh, yes. So there was a time before I set up Design Science when I was frustrated enough to start learning tango, and there were some quite cheesy songs, but this one I really like, called Volver, Carlos Gardel.
Adivino el parpadeo de las luces que a lo lejos van marcando mi retorno. Son las mismas que alumbraron con sus pálidos reflejos hondas horas de dolor. Y aunque no quise el regreso, siempre se vuelve al primer amor. La vieja calle donde el eco dijo tuya es su vida, tuyo es su querer, bajo el burlón mirar de las estrellas que con indiferencia hoy me ven volver.
Times New Roman was created for the Times newspaper of London in 1931.
News just in. A new device allows cows to text message their farmers when they're sick or pregnant.
Oh, sorry, I've got to come up with mine. My headline was, I haven't got it with me. Oh, God, I've really missed this one.
I actually found out that red squirrels have been found to carry a form of leprosy. And also, I think you found out that Nicholas Stern's 10-year climate review reveals that the cost of global warming is worse than he feared.
Is terrifying with the fact that Trump is now in power and doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah, it's just a conspiracy made up by the Chinese.
My second story was actually that despite Trump being in power, nations will push ahead with their climate change plans. There was a UN climate talk in Morocco literally 3-4 days ago, and President Trump said in his campaign that he's going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement, which is where all the countries came together and agreed that they wouldn't let global warming go above 2 degrees. And so to stop him doing that, they've rushed through to make it binding part of international law that people have to stick to this agreement, so that if he tries to extract America from it, it's going to take him at least 4 years.
I've got my list in front of me again. So my other one was about it was a story in Nature in the summer about stopping the privatisation of health data. So this is quite a big one for the NHS, with the people like Google and the big companies, who are going to start. They have a lot of data, and the question is, should patients have access to their own data or not? And there are big implications of either of those options.
Yeah, I guess it's a difficult question, because you kind of have a right to your own,
absolutely,
to look at your own data, but then if you open up to someone, then that means that other people can come in. If you have responsibility for your own data, you can give it to someone else freely, and then that means companies have huge amounts of data. So I'm unsure. It's kind of like two ways to look at it.
And when you say privatisation, are they then like using that data and selling it to researchers?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think it's absolutely outrageous. I think we should definitely have access to our own data, because I think we should have access to a lot more of our data. I mean, that's more questionable whether that's good or bad. But I think that our own health data has to be something that we need to know, not least because I think it would only help us to know more about our own bodies. I think it would help us make decisions. I think it would help us be interested. I think it would help on educational levels. I've been working with a company called Spoonful of Sugar, who are a UCL spin-out company, and they do this research trying to get patients to be better at taking their own medicines. 50% of patients don't take their medicine as prescribed in the world. This is a complete waste of resources, of time, of money. And I think design could have a big part to play in helping those situations. But I also think that if patients know more about their situation, they'll be in a better position to understand why taking that medication is a good idea.
And Carl, I think we kind of rushed over this, but I'm so curious about this. Red squirrels are carrying a new form of leprosy.
Well, so actually, they are not carrying a new form of leprosy, but they're carrying the same forms that used to be prevalent in the human population. So there are two kind of main types of leprosy, two different bacteria, really. And one's called Mycobacterium leprae, and the other one's called Mycobacterium lepromatosis. And they've found red squirrels within the UK are actually carrying this bacteria around, and some of them are exhibiting the symptoms of leprosy. And so this answers a big question, which is, how does the bacteria survive when no one in the UK really has leprosy anymore? It can be combated just by taking a very simple antibiotics, that's the word I'm looking for. And so it can be easily cured, but it then still exists. And the idea is that these red squirrels are acting as a reservoir of that bacteria, and that's allowing it to come back into the human population. I must say that it's very unlikely you're going to catch leprosy from a squirrel, but yeah, I mean, you're probably more likely to catch rabies or something. So maybe best...
Not too much to be worried about at the moment.
No. But, you know, just observe the red squirrels from a distance.
Yeah, don't get too close. Not as cute and cuddly as they might look.
No.
And what was your second story?
So mine was that apparently a fossilised dinosaur brain has been found in the south of England. And so this is amazing because when you're looking at fossils, it's obviously very difficult to preserve soft tissue because it's much more likely to decay than bone. And so they found the skull of a dinosaur that's 133 million years old. And inside you can see some of the formations of the blood vessels in the brain.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so this is amazing. This is going to, you know, help hopefully give some more insight into actually what the brains of these animals were like.
And why did it survive? How did it survive, this brain?
I think you just get a particular condition where you get really good fossils. And so normally for that sort of thing, you have a lack of oxygen or things can be very dry. And that helps to preserve them. I'm not exactly sure what the conditions were for this one. But it's very unlikely that you actually get this kind of preservation.
That's amazing. My final news story of the week, sneaking in a third one here, just a little shout out to the fact that we're going to have the biggest supermoon in almost 70 years on the 13th of November, so coming up next week.
Well, let's hope the weather isn't like this.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope we have some clear skies.
So what does the supermoon mean?
So a supermoon, there's two criteria. It must be a full moon, and it's a moon that's at the point in its orbit where it's particularly close to the Earth, because the moon's orbit is a bit oval. And that means that it looks a lot bigger and a lot brighter than a normal full moon. 30% brighter than normal.
That's quite a lot, really, isn't it?
Yeah, like, that is a lot. So if there are no clouds, head out on the 13th and see if you can see the supermoon. You won't see one as bright again until 2034.
Ooh, I'm dead by then.
On that morbid note, what is your next song?
The next song is Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. This is a much more recent one that I've discovered. Sister Rosetta goes before us, and my daughter Alice absolutely loves dancing to this. And so I've grown to like it quite a lot.
Oh, shout out to Alice then.
Strange things are happening every day. I hear the music up above. looks like I've lost the love I've never found.
In 1992, NASA Administrator Daniel Gordon officially retired the Worm logo to bring back the 1959 Meatball logo.
How important do you think logos are in a design communication way?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I remember doing at university this thing called, it was an anti-logo campaign. I think they're everywhere. The interesting thing is, I kind of just sort of thought we don't really need logos. Now what's happened is this social media where you sort of do need them. It's quite an odd thing.
You've got all these little images.
You need your small icon now. So we've got there's a new situation with logos. I mean, I've always thought that I think brands, which is what logos are part of, logos need to be designed as part of a brand for everybody now. You don't want to be stuck with the same thing that you've got to use over and over in exactly the same way. And so there needs to be flexibility in these brands. And in fact, one of the very nice ones is the IBM logo designed by Paul Rand, which is amazing. I mean, you can see a good logo when it lasts as long as his one has. But he used to play with that logo, and one of his famous interpretations of it was that he changed the I of the IBM into a human eye, and the B was a buzzing bee, and just the M remained, and you totally still knew it was IBM. So when you can get a logo that you can muck around with, then it's great. But what I hate is these ones that you just get plastered, like Coca-Cola, everywhere. In third world countries, they paint it on exactly as in its same form. And it does feel like some very hostile kind of ownership of someone else's.
So Google have done quite an interesting thing where they, with their every day or, you know, every few days, they kind of changed the logo and for a theme and things, so they're kind
on
of their
homepage.
Logo is, and it's kind of changing every day. It's they've managed to kind of incorporate the letters into every different logo every day.
Obviously they've got time to spend on this stuff but time and money to spend. I think of course that's much nicer than having to see. I think we'd all be absolutely going nuts if every time we looked up a word, which is about 100 times a day I think, we would have to see the logo. So I think that's a very smart idea that they've done there.
I mean, my only sort of real experience with logo creation was creating the logo for this show, and that was even picking a name and making sure that it was a name that was going to last. Like, we had quite a lot of conversations, didn't we, Carl, coming up with it?
Yeah, so. Spoke for a long time.
I mean, if I'm going to give a top tip about how to design a decent logo, I would say try it in all the contexts you think you'll ever use it in. Try it over an image, try it in one colour. Don't just make a beautiful logo on one page and then just think that's it. People don't test these things out.
Does it look good when it's big, when it's small?
Exactly. And you might want a different version of it at large size and small size, which is what some publishing companies do. So Fiden will have a smaller version to go on the spine of a book than it will on the front. So it's quite good to think about it in that context.
And what have you got coming up? What are the projects you're working on at the moment?
So we are very soon going to be launching some films for the NHS about cancer procedures that you have when you might have cancer for patients. So they're 3 or 4 minutes... animations that we've made where they're very carefully produced, and I'm quite excited about the implications of those being released. Hopefully they will save time from nurses having to explain the procedures to the patients, and they will hopefully help the patients understand what's going to happen and make them feel less fearful. We've made lots of design decisions to think about all of those contexts, and we have just in the middle of working on an evolution website, which is reviewing, it's called Extended Evolutionary Synthesis, and it has a £5 million or $8 billion grant. I think the pound is now dropped rather a lot in value from what it was, but to review the theories of evolution and extend on them. I think we don't want to be worrying all the people who are very worried about old theories going down the tube, but and then a project with UCL called Metabolite, which is about sort of firing light into brains and being able to detect metabolic rates, which is very useful for babies who might be born with birth asphyxia and they're running out of oxygen. And this is a very clever way of not detecting how much oxygen is being used, but how well that oxygen is being used.
Yes, of course, because they will only produce the metabolic waste if they are going through that respiration process and burning the oxygen.
So this is something that I think ultimately they would like to have implemented into hospitals. So we're doing a public engagement project, which will be showing at science festivals to try and get public awareness about this and then try to get the NHS to take it on.
That's so cool and so varied, all three of them.
Yeah,
wow.
Very exciting work going on.
Well, we don't have very much time left, so Kyle, what is everyone's favourite font? What have we been hearing?
Well, so I've chosen my favourite font, and I've chosen Textura.
Oh.
Which is an obscure black letter, but it was the first font that was used on the Gutenberg printing press.
Oh, very good.
So I
wow,
got that one.
A historical
and
one.
And it still exists. It's still in Unicode on a computer, so it still actually has all of the fonts, and you can still use it, which I think is amazing. We've had a tweet from John Shepherd saying that he's still trying to install the font of all knowledge. good luck with that one.
Thank you very much for that, John Shepherd. My favourite font is Optima, which you can find on most normal kind of word processing things.
Solid font.
I just think it looks really pretty. That's my much less interesting reason.
I always tell my students not to just say that. They So my favourite font is called Caslon Sans, and it's the very first sans serif font that was designed in 18-something. I should know the date because I didn't get this prepared. I've just thought of it, but it is a really amazingly beautiful sans serif, and it just looks as modern today as it must have done. It must have looked very modern when it was first developed. I think one of the things I really value about good design is that when it's good, it lasts.
It's timeless.
Yeah.
Lovely. What is your final song to play us out on?
This is Tom Waits, Fumbling with the Blues, which at one point on our journey was the only song I managed to play on my iPhone, and played it again and again and again and again, and I still like it.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been so interesting.
Thank you. I'm a pool shooting shimmy shyster shaking my head when I should be living clean instead. You know the ladies I've been seeing on. Well, it's been too long and they're gone. You can't be loving someone who's savage and cruel. Yeah. Take your love and then they leave on out of town.
My name is Nochem Volpe. I am a researcher at the University of Cambridge. What I currently look at is how aging affects the motor system, and particularly what predicts healthy aging in the motor system.
Okay, and so specifically, what is it you're looking at the moment?
So specifically, I'm involved in this large interdisciplinary project that's going on in Cambridge. It's called CAMCAN. And the project is a cross-sectional study, so that we look at people from across the lifespan, collecting for one individual, a whole bunch of cognitive tasks that tap into cognitive abilities. And the idea is to see what predicts healthy, normal aging.
Okay, so how do you go about doing that? What do you use to look into this?
So here the idea was to use completely non-contentious tasks that have been looked at for many years, and to see whether you look at different cognitive domains such as memory, language. I'm the one who's looking at the motor domain, the actions system, and even more general perceptual systems. And there is also quite a few different neurophysiological data, and specifically brain imaging, for example, magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, and different sequences of MRI, one that's called functional MRI. So this is about looking at how the brain is active when people do different tasks or when people just lie in the scanner and do nothing. And we use a task that is called the force matching task. The task measures how much force people have to apply on their own finger in order to experience, to have the same sensory experience as an external force that is applied to their finger in this case. So we found that 98% of people overcompensate. But what was also interesting was the age-related effect that we found. And that is that older adults tend to apply larger forces in order to have the same sensory experience. We found that older adults were more accurate overall in matching the force. We can then go on to ask what these changes mean for these people in terms of their motor behavior, motor problems in movement, for instance, falls or balance. And this is exactly what we're looking at now. We're asking is how this change actually predicts other changes in healthy aging.
3 minute science.
3 minute science.